Good. Well, before we go there, I think was it you that, yes, it was you who asked me about the other side of the three poisons, in the transformation. And I went to the kind of Vajrayana or tantric. Out of those three, you generate other, there are other consequential negative emotions. Now, anger was the example, and that can become discriminating wisdom. But even without going there, if you go back, so I had a check, and I thought, if they come that way, then you must be able to see them immediately. And so, for ignorance, the opposite is prajna or wisdom. There's another one called amoha, because moha is like a subset of ignorance, which means non-delusion. But I think prajna or wisdom is the more obvious and positive one. And for attachment, it's alopa or non-attachment. But again, the obvious positive one is dana or generosity. Because non-attachment is sensed in a form of aversion, to be generous. And avesa, non-hatred. Non-aversion. And the obvious positive one is metta, or the cultivation of loving kindness. So wisdom, generosity, and loving kindness are the opposites of the three poisons: ignorance, attachment, and aversion, or greed and hatred would probably fit better with generosity and loving kindness. Yeah, does that make sense? Okay, so we were kind of looking at the fundamental nature of ignorance, and how, in that sense, it can be seen as really the root cause, the fundamental cause of suffering and the origin of suffering. So, if you can eliminate or uproot that, then the other two, attachment and aversion, don't have any purchase. So, there's lots of ways of, in many spiritual traditions and practices, of suppressing or trying to transform greed and hatred, dealing with attachment, the unpleasant effects of unwholesome attachment and aversion. But it is kind of suppressing. It can be a very long job, or an endless battle. But if you can actually cut the root, which is ignorance in this sense of misperceiving things, actively misperceiving things as having a reality or an existence that they don't really have, seeing appearances in that sense as reality, permanent, not and all of that, then it is a way to go to really cut the root of suffering. But just before we go back there, you remember I was talking about craving as tanha, the eighth. Tanha in Pali, Trishna in Sanskrit, as the eighth link in the sort of chain of dependent arising. That's like an immediate cause. Once we are, that kind of drives, because once we're under the power of delusion, once we're under the power of ignorance, that's when tanha can arise. And I suppose the easiest English term for that, not perfect, is craving. It's the desire to kind of hold on to pleasurable experiences and wanting to be separated from and getting rid of painful or unpleasant experiences, and wanting neutral experiences or feelings not to decline. It's a very natural thing. We all want happiness, we all want pleasure, and we don't want pain. However, we understand those terms or their reference. I found a good quote from an author called Ron Liefer. He wrote a book called The Happiness Project back in 1997. He said, "Tanner is itself bipolar, divided into greed and hatred, or passion and aggression. On the one hand is the desire to have something, to possess it, to experience it, to pull it in, to own it. On the other hand is the desire to avoid something, to keep it away, reject it, renounce it, destroy it, separate it from oneself. If we call these two poles desire and aversion, we can see more clearly that they represent the antithetical poles of tanha, the desire to possess and the desire to get rid of." And it's spoken of back in the Buddha's first sermon, you know, when he was saying, we want those things that we don't have enough of and want to get rid of the things that we don't want too much of. It's a bipolar kind of quality. And then he goes on to say, "Desire causes suffering by its own nature because it's inherently unsatisfactory. Desire means deprivation. To want something is to lack it, to be deprived of it. We don't want things we have, we only want things we don't have. Thirst is the desire for water, and it occurs in the absence of water. Hunger is the feeling of lacking food. Desiring means not having, being frustrated, suffering." So in this sense, craving is suffering. It's a very immediate cause. But the craving is only occurring because of the ignorance of misperceiving appearances for reality. So he says, this is a most important insight, one which we drive into secrecy by our refusal to acknowledge it, thus creating the esoteric knowledge that we then seek. He's using the word esoteric solely in the hidden meaning. We hide the very thing we're looking for. So to kind of repeat what I was saying earlier, the ignorant dualistic mind, the avidya, actively mistaking or misperceiving appearances for reality, clings, craves or thirsts. And tanha, the eighth link of the 12 links of dependent origination. And passion, aggression and delusion result. They're movements in thought created by habitual patterns in behaviour. So this one is the immediate cause of suffering, but the root fundamental cause is ignorance or avidya. And if you can cut that off at the root, you can most effectively bring about the cessation of suffering. In fact, sometimes in some Mahayana and Vajrayana texts, they'll actually define suffering as a failure to understand that things don't exist as they appear. They'll actually say suffering is caused, you know, that suffering is not realizing that ourselves, things, phenomena don't have any inherent existence. And that's how that's the underlying thinking there. Yeah, you know, that's the kind of way it goes. So the source of the problem is the ignorance. And then as a result of the ignorance, the craving leading to attachment or aversion, depending which of the poles we're at, either wanting something or wanting to get rid of something, occurs. How does that occur? Maybe I'll stop there before I go on to the how does it occur. Is that clear so far? Are there any questions? There's one that often comes up in the sense when you get to craving, which and then it's cashed out in terms of desire, then you sometimes get a misunderstanding that lots of people approaching Buddhism have, where they think it's all about the end of desire. Well, it's not, of course. It's the end of unwholesome desire. Desire based upon a fundamental ignorance. It's not the attempt to somehow turn us all into beyond Spocks. In fact, it's to engage with and have a richer life. I mean, the desire... are we not all here because of the desire for enlightenment? It would be considered to be a wholesome desire, eh? So, I don't want to sidetrack us there, but there is a distinction between wholesome and unwholesome desire, and it's based on the objective. The unwholesome are these ones that occur because we misperceive the appearances for reality and then act out of attachments or aversions to them. Yeah. Okay, so if we go back to that phenomenological approach, just trying to be with what's immediately before us as things appear, whatever appears, you know, in the Bahia Sutta, you know, in the scene is the scene, in the herd is the herd, and so on. That's fine, but if we watch or are with, present to this idea of, I'm not that keen, or I understand it, but I'm not that keen on the idea of there is something that watches something else. It's more a question of, are we present to it, are we awake to it, or are we asleep to it? Otherwise, that kind of dualism is going to create a problem further down the line. A neat way, though, it is of picking up a part of the carpet to see under the rest. There is the very idea that there's something separate to all of this that can watch my perceptions is a funny notion. So it's more a question of being present to it. If we're present to it, then we notice that there is this kind of ignorance is not just conditioned, we accentuate it by conditioning, but there's a bit of an innate disposition there. The how things appear to the senses kind of encourage or play their part in generating this idea, you know, back to the developmental thing. So this, what we see, hear, smell, taste and feel in the sense of sensations, not emotions, things seem to exist in their own right, independently, out there, separate to me, self-sufficient, and so on and so forth. And that begins to start, or is the basis for, the attractions and the aversions and the cravings. So one of the biggest way, or one of the easiest ways in, but one of the biggest obstacles to understanding and having a good knowledge of the processes at work and the current conditions in which they work, could simply be kind of old friends, I, me, and mine, you know, very strongly rooted in that, which is what, in effect, personal bias. You know, either that we just have a disposition that way, or we've been brought up that way, or been conditioned that way by experience. And it's a huge problem, you know, an extreme example of that is a person who suffers from a form of paranoia and assumes that they know that everyone and everything is out to get them. And as a result of that, they interpret everything that happens to them in the light of that. And as we know, it's not necessarily true and leads to an enormous amount of suffering. So if we're kind of genuinely seeking self-knowledge, realizing and manifesting as we really are, it'd be of immense value to be able to kind of sidestep personal biases. Yeah, it would be to sort of get over them and develop an ability to interpret events in a more interdependent, intersubjective light, you know, somewhat freer of personal bias, accepting here that there's no absolute God's eye view or inherently existing concrete or permanent reality. Now, unaided, it seems a difficult thing to do, because rooted as we are in our habits and behaviours, we tend to see what we see and think what we think. And that's it. And we carry on in that way, generating suffering. Now, there's a bit, I thought His Holiness dealt with this really well, so I'll quote from the book, and then we'll have from we might have sort of 20-25 minutes to do a bit of meditation on it. So he starts off, this is his chapter two called Discovering the Source of the Problems. He starts off with a quote from Patril Rinpoche's Sacred Word, and it says, "Attracted by light and heat, a moth flies into a flame. Stunned by the sounds of a guitar, a deer stands unaware of a hunter. Drawn by the scent of a flower, a bug is trapped inside. Attached to taste, a fish rushes to a hook. Pulled to mud, an elephant cannot escape." Then His Holiness says, "Our senses contribute to our ignorance. Our faculties of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and feeling, in the sense of sensations again, objects seem to exist in their own right. Presented with distorted information, the mind assents to this exaggerated status of things. Buddhists call such a mind ignorant for accepting this false appearance instead of resisting it. The ignorant mind doesn't question appearances to determine if they're correct. It merely accepts that things are as they appear. Next, we become committed to the seeming truth of the concreteness of objects, thinking, if this is not true, what could possibly be true? As we do so, our ignorant misapprehension gets stronger. For instance, when we first encounter something or someone nice, we briefly take notice of the object of our attention, merely recognizing its presence. The mind at this point is pretty much neutral. But when the circumstances cause us to pay more attention to the object, it appears to be attractive in a way that's integral to the object." Beautiful tankers. Beautiful day. Might be the other way, but he's giving like a positive example. "It appears to be attractive in a way that's integral to the object. When the mind adheres to the object in this way, thinking that it exists as it appears, desire for the object and hatred for what interferes with getting it can set in." Whereas it is what it is, you know, beauty being in the eye of the beholder, that beauty, that attraction is something, you know, it's not completely individual, we share it with other beings of similar kind, but as we also know, some people do find things wonderful that other people don't find so wonderful, or tasty that are not so tasty, and so on and so forth. That's the part of the projection. That's what we're throwing in there. It is what it is. And if we just looked at it from a point of view of pure perception, as I said, perceptions in that sense are empty. The conceptual apparatus puts the stuff in there that makes it good, bad, indifferent or whatever, and that's based on our experience and conditioning and so on. So when the mind adheres to the object in this way, thinking that it exists as it appears, desire for the object and hatred for what interferes with getting it can set in. When our own self is involved, we emphasize that connection. Now it is my body, my stuff, my friends, my car. We exaggerate the object's attractiveness, obscuring its faults and disadvantages. I mean, I can't, probably all the same, but it sort of burnt on my memory from childhood that when you really want something in the shop that you're going to spend your pocket money on, and your parents or your friends might say, it's not as good as it looks. It's, no, that's really wonderful. I really want one of those. And then you parted with the money and get it out. And it's kind of like, oh, they were right. It's not quite what I thought it was. We exaggerate the object's attractiveness, obscuring its faults and disadvantages. That's the one I want. And become attached to it as helpful in acquiring pleasure, whereby we are forcibly led into desire for it as if by a ring in our nose. We might also exaggerate the object's unattractiveness, making something minor into a big defect. Yeah. From an early age, I don't know why I found the taste of cooked egg white, not the taste, it's something to do with the texture. But I made an awful fuss about it. It took me years to think, okay, it's just egg white. It's not my favourite, but I can actually eat it. You know, whereas before it's like, I've got a gag. You know, it's, you exaggerate its unattractiveness. Because people say, well, why can't you eat it? It was just an invitation to then big up all the horrible things that it was, such that, oh, if that goes past my epiglottis, I'm going to be sick and die, you know. It gets totally exaggerated. So it's that, this gives you a bit graphic, but it'll give you a feeling for what's going on. Making something minor into a big defect, ignoring its better qualities, and now we view the object as interfering with our pleasure, being lured into hatred, again, as if by a ring in our nose. Even if the object doesn't seem to be either agreeable or disagreeable, but just an ordinary thing in the middle, ignorance continues to prevail, although in this case it doesn't generate desire or hatred. Then he quotes Nagarjuna, an Indian scholar yogi, from his 60 stanzas of reasoning and says, how could great poisonous afflictive emotions not arise in those whose minds are based on inherent existence? Even when an object is ordinary, their minds are grasped by the snake of destructive emotions. And there's also a nice one there that's in the tradition, the analogy or the metaphors used in all sorts of ways. You often see, it's always good to see the context because it has different meanings, but here it's got, would have the context of the business of mistaking the rope for the snake. You know, you're out at this time of the year, see a rope, and then you think it's a snake. Well, all the things that would normally happen to you if it was a snake occur. You're frightened, you don't know what to do, the heart beats, it palpitates, and then maybe putting a torch on it and you see it's a rope. I sort of, oh, what was all that about? So it gives you an idea of how the perception and adding our perceptions, kind of adding to the idea that something inherently exists as something, kind of accentuates all of this. And he says, cruder conceptions of I and mine evoke grosser destructive emotions such as arrogance and belligerence, making trouble for yourself, your community, and even your nation. These misconceptions need to be identified by watching your own mind. And then he quotes Dharmakirti, who says, in one who exaggerates self, there is always adherence to I. Through that adherence, there's attachment to pleasure. Through attachments, disadvantages are obscured. The advantage is seen, whereby there is strong attachment. And objects that are mine as taken up as a means for achieving pleasure. Hence, as long as there is attraction to self, so long do you revolve in cyclic existence. So then this is the important one, and it's something, again, we can kind of reflect on over the week because we're in a good situation to do it. It's crucial to identify and recognise different thought processes. Some thoughts merely make us aware of an object, such as seeing a watch just as a watch, without any afflictive emotions like greed or desire for it. Other thoughts determine correctly that an object is good or bad, but still don't introduce any afflictive emotions. These thoughts just recognise good as good and bad as bad. However, when the idea that objects inherently exist takes hold, fundamental ignorance has been introduced. As the mistaken assumption of inherent existence becomes stronger, greed or hatred become involved. The turning point from mere awareness to misconception comes when ignorance exaggerates the status of the goodness or badness of the object, so that it comes to be seen as inherently good or bad, inherently attractive or unattractive, inherently beautiful or ugly. Ignorantly misjudging this false appearance to be fact opens the way for greed, hatred, and myriad other counterproductive emotions. These destructive emotions in turn lead to actions based on desire and hatred. These actions establish predispositions in the mind that drive the process of psychic existence from life to life. He's talking here, but going back to the one life thing there. So now we could do his reflective meditation on that. We've got sort of 20, 25 minutes. We're due to finish at 2:15. Check the session again. Yeah, 3:45. So let's have a go at that, and we can all please ourselves as respect the object, but the kind of this kind of more analytical meditation kind of depends on bringing an object to mind that you find attractive. It could be absolutely anything, it's your choice, but something that you really find attractive. Yeah? Any absolutely anything at all. So if we just spend a little bit of time, so you can think about it, think what sort of object you want to bring to mind, and then kind of establish it, you know, whatever it is, object, person, whatever it is, but it's something that you find particularly attractive. In your own time, when you've established an object, and you can sit as we were sitting before, you know, just resting in the wider awareness of where this is taking place, bringing to mind, or maybe even having an image of the thing we find very attractive. And then just consider, does the attractiveness of that object seem to be integral to it? Does it seem to be built in? You know, as soon as we see it in the mind's eye, as it were, we think, oh yes, that's very attractive. Does it appear that way? See if you can consider whether that's how it appears. Does the mere imagination or visualization of it, sort of bringing it before you in the mind's eye, increase the pull, increase the magnetic attraction? Is it the sort of thing where you think, oh, well, the longer I look at that, the more attractive it gets? And is that almost magnetic attraction, again, integral to the object or whatever it is? You can open up to yourself here. Don't be frightened to let desire and attraction burn if it's something you really like. And all the better that you see and feel it for what it is. But all the while in the back of the mind considering, is it somehow built in? Is it sort of out there in that object pulling me in? Good if you can have picked an object that's a kind of a must-have rather than something you just vaguely might like. If we're honest, we've all usually got one or two of those around. We might even avoid them because we don't want to burn for something that we want that we can't have right now. But all the time thinking, is that attraction, that attractiveness, integral to what we're objectifying or not? And then try to consider if that magnetic attractiveness of the object obscures its faults and disadvantages. Does it disincline us to consider its faults and disadvantages? You might test that by actually asking, has it got any? Is there a resistance to considering the faults and disadvantages of it? Then consider if exaggeration of the pleasantness of certain aspects of it increase the desire for it. You can really go to town on it. Imagine you're working for an advertising agency and trying to make it even more attractive to people who maybe don't find it as attractive as you do. And see if that playing it up, talking it up to yourself, indulging that leads to an increase in the desire for it. Does exaggeration of its pleasantness and attraction increase your desire for it. So if you find that the attractiveness either obscures or makes it difficult to consider its faults and disadvantages, or by talking it up and really exaggerating it turns up the volume of your desire for it, what does that say about whether the attractiveness of the object is integral to it, or is it lying in something that you're bringing to it? And then again, as before, I think does exaggerating the unpleasantness or disadvantages of certain aspects of the object, does that drive towards a lack of desire for it, a feeling it's not quite what it was? If you picked an object you already disliked, could it, if you exaggerate those features that you don't like, does that start to go towards quite strong feelings of dislike and hatred for it? Does the volume go up? Does it amplify it? And then, still in kind of considering mode, see if you can go back to how you first perceived the object. How did it appear when you first saw it, or it first came before your mind? And then, when did you notice if the object was kind of good or bad, desirable or undesirable? And then did you conclude or notice that the object had its own independent basis for existing? Did it appear to exist like that, wholly from its own side? Did that lead you to conclude that the object's attractiveness or ugliness, goodness or badness exist inherently in the object? This thing or this person is like that. Then did you see how desire or like or tense hatred, dislike, generated according to your previous judgments? Yeah, when you've kind of considered that, just let go. Relax back into the nature of awareness, either wherever you find yourself or draw it into the space of the heart. Just rest there, letting everything else go. Cease to analyze or rest with whatever experience you have.